I'm Liz Joyner. On behalf of the Village Square Board of Directors and their families, it is my pleasure to welcome you to Dinner at the Square, our 13th season, a local press, ghost papers, news deserts, and the future of democracy. Our program is part of a full year of programming we're calling the Year of Living Locally, focusing on the power of local communities to overcome both the partisan divide and also to create intelligent solutions to the problems that confront us. We want to thank our season sponsors, the Tallahassee Democrat. We're delighted to have a contingency from the Democrat here tonight, who you'll meet later. But for now, William Hatfield, editor, give a wave. Well, and Tallahassee Democrat reporters, give a wave, too. Anybody else who's a journalist in the room, raise your hand. All right. Well, welcome. We appreciate all of you. And we'd like to thank our other season sponsor, Johnson & Blanton, who highly are not likely to be here tonight because I believe they're a few blocks up that way doing their business. Anyone from Johnson & Blanton here tonight? Right, we thank them very much. We're delighted to be working with the Florida League of Cities this year as we fully embrace the power of local communities to get the job done and create their future. And I'm hoping somewhere is Jeannie Garner and Jenna Talla. Give a wave. Florida League of Cities. Anyway. And we're grateful to our dinner sponsor for this particular dinner, Periodontal Associates of North Florida, without whom the dinner would not be possible. John Dozier, as is true for many of the Doziers, have been longtime friends, attendees, and generous supporters of the Village Square. And when we talked about this program first, John told me a great sense. He reflected on local journalism, and I asked him to come say a word tonight.
Good evening, everyone. It's a pleasure to see such a good and great turnout this evening. And I want to thank Liz Joyner for your direction and leadership. The vision that Alan Katz, Ambassador Katz, had for this Village Square, you have done a wonderful job carrying it forward and realizing his vision. And as I understand it, there are other cities trying to copy what we do. So that is very, very good stuff. Tonight's topic is truly resonates with me. I started reading The Democrat 55 years ago as a 10-year-old. And I can tell you, well, there you are. Thank you. We had a football powerhouse in this town, the legendary coach, early 1960s, Jake Gaither, and the human bullet, Bob Hayes, fastest human, in the 100-yard dash. But FSU wanted to also get out from underneath the University of Florida's shadow. And so it is that Bill McGrother fueled my passion for sports. I would turn to the sports page and read every line of his articles for years. And FSU was such a, second-rate academic status to the Gators that it took the legislature to force Florida to play FSU. So there was a lot of community interest in seeing another university in this town come to that level of competition. And, of course, the rest is history. After reading the sports page, I would read I Declare. The editor of the paper, Malcolm Johnson, had various observations about our community that, for me, gave me an opportunity to enjoy what other people are thinking. Now, that brings us to a local press. Who are we as a community, and what are other people thinking? And I recall one of his articles was about where to place Interstate 10, through town, north of town, and he took a Jeep ride to kind of see what he thought was a way to show off North Florida with the path that it takes today, with the topography and such. So there were plenty of things about his articles that I could appreciate through the years. Let me flash forward to when I was a student at FSU. I then learned town and gown were not on the same page. Pardon the pun. Social justice issues, the war in Vietnam, there was a very different point of view of who we are as a community and what our local paper was all about. So I wanted to give that some history for people who are sitting at my table from the Democrat, that there is no other entity that I can think of that really reveals who we are as a community than our local newspaper. And I have a 55-year perspective. So thank you for listening to that, and welcome everyone, and enjoy the program.
Thank you, John. We ask you to not do team clapping where, you know, somebody on your side of the aisle says something you like and you go, yay, and then somebody on the other side of the aisle says something you don't like very much and you go, ooh. So if you can sit on your hands a little bit this evening and hold your opinions lightly for 90 minutes, we think that you'll get more out of it, and we'll all come out of here alive, which is my goal. I really want to walk out of this room with as many people who have a determination that we will keep local journalism alive and well in this community, that it will... And I think it's going to take that kind of determination. It takes a community, and ultimately, it's us. We are the ones who decide. All right, before I introduce our facilitator and panel for the evening, I am very sad to say, though I guess happy for her, that Dr. Ann Kimbrough of FAMU School of Journalism and Graphic Communications won't be here tonight because she got a job in Atlanta. And she has to be at her job in Atlanta today. And she actually did toy with the idea of flying back, and it just didn't work. So she tried. I'm not sure about her priorities, Village Square dinner, employment, you know. But we will wish Ann well. So I'm going to just introduce everyone here this evening so we can just be right in the conversation all the way through. Joining us for the first part of the conversation, and there, feel free to make your way on up, is Jennifer Portman is our facilitator for the evening. Recently named the National Enterprise Editor for USA Today. Lucky for us, she'll be staying in Tallahassee. Jennifer was with the Tallahassee Democrat more than a decade, first as an investigative reporter and most recently as the Democrat's news director. Jennifer hails from Los Angeles. She earned her master's degree from Northwestern's famed Medill School of Journalism, beginning her journalism career in 1995 as a general assignment reporter at the News Ledger in Springfield, Missouri. Even if you haven't met Jennifer, I'm pretty sure that you know her because she's really been center of gravity of so many of the important stories in our community over the years. Skip Foster was the 10th publisher. Yeah, you can clap now. Clapping now is cool. Was the 10th publisher of the Tallahassee Democrat, coming to town in 2015 after serving as publisher of the North Florida Daily News. A native of Lakeland, Florida, Skip began his career as a sports writer. It is not an understatement, I believe, to say that his recent departure from the Democrat was really a gut punch to our community. Marianne Class is the Capitol Bureau Chief for Miami Herald, where she covers government, and politics, and focuses on investigative and accountability reporting. During the 2018-19 academic year, Mary Ellen was awarded a Nieman Fellowship to study at Harvard University and was named the 2019 Murray Martyr Nieman Fellow in Watchdog Journalism. And after Jennifer, Skip, and Mary Ellen have done a deep dive on tonight's topic, they'll be joined by, and you can give them their applause now, Bob Sanchez. Bob. As a longtime member of the Miami Herald editorial board, Bob won a Pulitzer Prize for a series of editorials reporting on the conditions of Haitian immigrants. He's taught English and journalism at Florida High, FSU, and Florida A&M. He also served as the director of public policy at James Madison Institute and is a veteran. And our final panelist for the evening, Steve Stewart, give a wave and applause. Steve is the editor of Tallahassee Reports, a local nonprofit watchdog news source. Steve received his master's degree in political science from FSU and went on to work with the Office of Public Counsel, where he provided testimony on behalf of consumers of Florida before the Florida Public Service Commission. Without further ado, if you're all mic'd up and ready to roll. It sort of feels like it's right in your face, right? But we'll be able to hear you. Jennifer.
Tell me if I'm too loud, because I've done some... Oh, there it is. Cool. I've done a little bit of TV, but this is like the weirdest thing right here. So excuse me while I get used to this moment. I'm here with two great people who I think that you all know by reputation and I'm lucky to know personally, and who are all survivors of this industry that you all are here.
Speak
and
for yourself.
Well, you're still here. I guess that was bad. I'm sorry. Still trying to make our way. I'm sorry. In what has definitely been not an easy industry to be in for me the last 25 years, I think we've all been there for a long time. So I think that we don't want this to become too maudlin of a discussion because we are still doing terrific journalism every single day. I have a really good perspective from being in the newsroom here in Tallahassee for a long time and helping to run that newsroom. And now from a national perspective, I'm reading even more stuff. And I will tell you that the content is alive and well out there. We just need to figure out this business model so that we can keep paying for really great journalism. So the content piece we are nailing with some of our amazing local journalists here and nationally. So I do want to give a plug for that. Mary Ellen has took a year off studying exactly what we're talking about tonight. So I want to let her have the floor first to sort of set the table for where we are right now. Mary Ellen.
Sure. Well, thank you. It's so encouraging to know that you all are here because you want to talk about local journalism. This is something that when I started my career 30-some years ago, I never expected that the trajectory would be going downhill instead of upwards. You always think your industry is going to get bigger. But instead, we have watched as the business model that for the last half century newspapers depended on has imploded. And that is because something new has changed our lives, and that's the internet, which we all probably would not want to go away. I would never want the internet, I would never go backwards if I had an option. Except that the internet is exactly the thing that killed newspapers, or is killing newspapers, because for years we had this business model that was dependent on advertising, and advertising was the way we were able to subsidize things like watchdog and explanatory journalism relating to government, because y'all wanted to see the FSU football and you'd pick up the paper and you'd get a story also about school board rezoning and, you know, traffic jams and problems like that. But that model has disappeared because the internet is now, 87% of all advertising goes to Facebook and Google because they know what to do with it better than the newspaper industry figured out. So because our advertising is now going somewhere else, we are dependent on subscriptions. And that's led to about a 60% drop in journalism jobs in the last 15 years. So that's where we are. It has
certainly been a challenge. Skip, you've been on the business side of this. I mean, can you give us a perspective from where you've sat? I mean, we've all sat through that. I mean, is anything that you can add to that?
Well, I was on the business end of something. I'm not sure. James at least thought that was funny. So, Jeff, thank you. Mary Ellen makes excellent points as usual. Digital traffic at newspapers is off the charts, right? We're getting, numbers that don't even mean anything to you. Millions and millions of page views. And if you say, well, page views isn't a way to measure traffic because that's kind of drive-by, we agree. And we look at all sorts of things like time spent on site and who's returning to the site and how sticky is their time. And those numbers are off the charts. The problem is in the when you know, pre-internet, print was the only way you could reach people, right? Only way you could reach our influential, affluent, engaged audience. All of those digital eyeballs and engagement we have now, there are many different ways to reach them. And what newspapers have said is, well, we're going to get in that business of doing digital marketing, not just to our own audience, but social media advertising and search engine optimization and stuff like this. And we're doing it, and we do it really well. Carrie Throw is here and has a team that sells that stuff and has platinum-level solutions for businesses in town. The problem is there are a lot of people selling that stuff, and they're not carrying around the cost structure of all of these journalists you see in here. That's a real economic challenge, right? You know, banks are kind of commoditized. You know, they want to they pretend to be different, but they're all the same. They all got about the same rates. They give you the same cookies and all that kind of stuff, right? Well, if one of them was carrying around the cost structure of local journalism, you'd say, oh, well, that's the one that's in big trouble, right? And so that's what we're really facing right now from a business standpoint in our industry.
Right. Well, and Marianne, can you talk a little bit about what that impact has been, you know, managing decline as we talk about, because every year we have less to work with in newspapers than we did the year before. So let that sink in. Every year we have less to do what everyone wants more of, and has been that for a long time. Talk a little bit to us with your research about what the impact has been on newsrooms, kind of in terms of resources.
Right. Well, you know, as the business model has declined and less revenue is coming in, we've watched this enormous consolidation, which we just witnessed in the last 2 months here in Tallahassee as Gatehouse became Gannett, and Gannett consolidated. And we've obviously seen that before as other news organizations around the country have consolidated. Well, with consolidation comes streamlining, and that means reduction of jobs. And just because you have fewer people doesn't necessarily mean that the product is getting better. In fact, you know, you have fewer people to do the journalism, and that means that you're going to have less content. And when you have less content, that also means you're discouraging more people about the product, and so that leads to fewer news sales. I think it's a never-ending decline, right?
One of the challenges newspapers have, you've heard this term newspaper of record, right? And what that means is you're responsible for everything. And the problem is that I have this old saying, everybody thinks that everybody thinks about the newspaper like they do, right? So we devote a lot of resources to FSU sports because there's lots and lots of interest in that. But there are people, and many of you in this room, that couldn't give a flip about FSU sports, right? So for you, that's wasted resource. Then there's the people that don't care about politics. They only care about recipes. And the people that don't care about recipes, they only care about the puzzles. And people don't, you know. And so when you're responsible for everything and your resources are shrinking, you just become disappointers, like chronic disappointers, which is really frustrating, right? Because the work that we are doing, and we're having to pick and choose, and I keep talking in the present tense, so just don't start crying if I do that. But, you know, the things that we choose, we have to make those tough decisions all the time. And it's heartbreaking when you have to say, hey, take your own picture and we'll put it online somewhere or do something like that. But the alternative is to not cover things that we know from research and other things are vitally important. You know, where the rubber meets the road, to wrap it up, is some things that are really, really, really important don't have that high of an interest. And some things that are really, really important, like deep investigative work, take so much time that to do it right, we would say no to virtually everything else that people are asking for. So those are where the decisions are tough.
And one of the interesting things, you know, when I went to journalism school, I never imagined that I would even care about how my newspaper made money. In fact, there was this giant wall that you weren't even supposed to pay attention to what the advertising side cared about. And you didn't, you know, everybody used to criticize reporters for writing a story because that was just going to sell newspapers. I can't tell you how many times that never even crossed my mind, because I would cover things over at the legislature that I knew not too many people would really care about reading, but if I didn't cover it, then those elected officials would know they weren't being watched. Mm-hmm. And I was going to be there just because it was something to do. So there's this situation that we are now in, and Skip refers to the digital audience. As reporters, we get reports on how often and how much our stories are read. So now my paper can not only track how many people are reading my stories, but they can tell me how far into the story they have read. And do you think that affects my newsmaking decisions? And and that is something I never imagined I'd be in.
And here's a newsflash. What you say you want to read is not what you actually read.
Yes, we have the numbers and how deep and how
long. Yeah, we know what you read, and it's not what you say you want to read.
Right. Well, I think one of the things that's interesting about Tallahassee as a news town, because, you know, we're the state capital, and so we have – there's two big enterprises going on here, right? We've got the local news, which is the car crashes and the school board and the stuff that happens in every town. And then we've got this big building back here with all of, you know, the politicians back. So we've got this double – focus on how's the Democrat doing? Well, they're not covering that well. So it kind of becomes even more intense with the focus. And I do want Mary Ellen to speak to, you know, so that's another part of Tallahassee where the Democrat is trying to cover local. We do cover the State House too. Talk about the changes that we've seen over time in our sort of second hometown newspaper up at the Capitol, just in the general with the press corps.
Well, so the Tallahassee press corps, when I started, was just like robust and on its peak. I think there were, during session, about 100 reporters. And newspaper, you know, you not only had newspapers with a staff up here that filled the press corps building or the press center building, but we had people sending up. At my newspaper, we would send up two reporters on a rotating basis, and, you know, that was for session only. So there was this, you know, enormous amount of people covering mm-hmm. what they were doing. Today, I think there are maybe 30 regular reporters on a regular basis, and during session, maybe we're at 40. And honestly, that includes the legacy media. But there's also this new breed of online journalism that is, some of which are only subscription. Right. So not everybody gets to see what they write unless you've subscribed to them exclusively. And I think that's exactly the reason I applied for this Nieman Fellowship, is because I've watched as the decline in reporters is changing behavior. And the fewer people there are to show up at these meetings, the more likely that there's less demand for transparency. And I think it's had an effect on democracy, and I think it's had an effect on how government is practiced, because more and more people, more elected officials just sort of like, no one's going to check. No one's going to bother. And I think when that happens, then we're in trouble.
Well, we had talked the other day when we were, when we had talked the other day about this, what also happens is you used to have a big story in Tallahassee, and let's say the Democrat would break the story, then you'd have the Herald would do a version of their story, and you'd have 7 or 8 different versions in the state of the same story, and that would amplify it, right? Now, because we're in this resource situation where we all these news organizations have to make really hard choices about what we cover, we don't see that, right? I mean, if the Herald's got it, well, the Herald's got it. Yeah. Anyone can go online, you know, if you pay your subscription price, see the Herald. So we then wouldn't duplicate that. So there's a lot of us all trying to do unique content, which I think what happens then is we lose things. So then you can hear like, well, the Tampa Bay Times had that story. Why don't you guys have that story? Well, we don't have that story because we want to do something else so we're not duplicating effort. And that's a big thing that goes on. I don't know if, you know, well, regular readers realize that that's kind of what we're doing.
Maybe
we're
all
so thin.
Do you guys all remember the trips and gifts scandal from the early 90s? So basically the Tallahassee Democrat broke the story about the trips and gifts of some legislators getting lobbyists, you know, a sweet deal from lobbyists, and my newspaper didn't have it, so we had to do our own version of it. And the Orlando Sentinel and the Palm Beach Post and the Fort Lauderdale newspaper and every newspaper did their version of it until every legislator got looked at. Mm-hmm. And the result was they changed the law. And as much as you think that law may have been a mistake, at least it forced them to do something. Today, we are writing investigative stories. We did a story on the assisted living, the abuse in assisted living communities in this state, and it took 4 years before the legislature even attempted to address that problem with any reforms. There's just no echo. There's no amplifying.
Right. Right. So that sort of explains why you guys might wonder, why did they? Because we can't. I mean, you know, we were talking about numbers. I know that when I started as news director at the Democrat, I found some ancient pile of papers, and in that ancient pile of papers, which wasn't really that ancient, which was, I think, from maybe 95, it was like a staff list, and there were 70 people on that list, you know, and you could look at who all was gone, and you just kept chopping them off, and there was, you know, maybe like 12 people left, right? So, you know, the newsroom is really shrunk locally, so we really do have to rely on how do we balance those resources? I mean, that is the landscape that we live in, and, you know, it really is challenging.
So you've heard a lot about business models and stuff like that. What you haven't heard about is the secret newsroom meetings where we pick out people that we want to run out of office and conspire to take them out, right? And policy initiatives that where we somehow are able to conspire with people in and out of government to bring about, you know, that's there's a lot of talk about, and I know, Liz, you've had panels on fake news and all, you know, the left and right version of those things. But, if you know, for us, it's really so comical because for a couple of reasons. One, we are not nearly smart enough to pull off the types of conspiracies of which we are accused, right? We're just not that bright. And secondly, this back to this newspaper of record thing, there's so much coming at us. The idea that we're going to spend time to carefully craft headlines that manipulate people into thinking one thing or another, I mean, it is absolutely Lucy at the chocolate machine, right? That's every day and every weekend, you know, too, in the business. So, you know, the challenges we're facing, it's not to say that people aren't getting turned off, and I understand that, but man, so much of it is smoke. And if you want to, in addition to supporting the Democrat and the Herald and any other local news outlet that you want with your time and dollars, you know, one thing you can do is just speak up when some of this, you know, craziness is being offered as the truth, because it's just, I've never been a part of a meeting like that. Nobody at Gannett ever told me what our editorial philosophy should be, what kind of editorial to write. Nobody ever did that. Nobody at Gannett ever said, oh, well, we're for a certain issue, so go write stories on an issue. That stuff is just ludicrous. Just doesn't happen. So anyway, glad to dispel that myth now that I'm finally out of the industry.
So I think we've hammered home to death the resource conundrum that we are in, which we often have very little control over. But one of the other challenges that is really facing local newspaper is the rise in social media. And, you know, if you look at institutions in this community, you know, part of it is it the chicken or the egg, right? School board, they spend a lot of money to have their own public information officer, U.S. Attorney's Office, State Attorney's Office. You know, all of our public entities now have these very robust, the city of Tallahassee, have their robust public information offices, which is okay, but in some ways we become irrelevant, right? Now, are they doing that because we no longer have the staff to cover it as we used to? In part. But, I mean, can you speak a little bit to that social media landscape, Mary Ellen?
You know, it's really interesting because when I started in Tallahassee, there were you know, the public information officers in state government were, you know, there was maybe one at an agency. Mm-hmm. There wasn't a huge staff of them. And their whole idea was to help us get right. information. Now, the whole reason for having a, it seems, mm-hmm. to having a media staff at all in government is to be a watchdog and a gatekeeper of information. Like, we're going to manage the message.
Yep.
We're not
going
to just
message.
Give you access mm-hmm. to the information. And that, I think, has just changed the dynamic. So when you have fewer resources, what happens is the people that are better at producing those press releases, actually, there was actually a study by Pew where they looked at the city of Baltimore, and they found that there were more stories appearing in the paper that came from press releases than there were from independent mm-hmm. news journalism in a city the size of Baltimore. Now, I'm sure if you're a public information expert, that's a great thing because you want to be able to control that message, but that's really bad for independent journalism mm-hmm. and for independence generally.
Yeah, I mean, it's something that I've really, really noticed it in my career that, and then it really does become this, like, it's not public information anymore. It's like the PR wing of your local government that you as taxpayers are paying for. And, you know, there is an agenda there, and I don't mean to be mean to, you know, the wonderful public information people, but it is, they call us angry if we dare go outside of their fly zone, and that's not an appropriate place for them to be. So I think that that's also a challenge, and that resonates with what you guys as readers end up seeing. You know, we have to rely on them in some respect because we can't hit it all. And we do want to tell you when, you know, the trash day is or some, you know, kind of thing that is not, you know, maybe controversial in any way. That's okay. But, you know, there are things that surely probably need more scrutiny that we kind of end up relying on them. And it's sort of a vicious circle. So, you know, that's something also. I think one of the things that obviously is a huge issue for local media is the difference, the partisan nature of media right now with the cable news networks and us here in the Tallahassee Democrat and here locally. So can one of you take on how that has, the differences between the Tallahassee Democrat, say, and MSNBC are vast. Can someone expand?
Yeah, I can talk about that. They're big. No, what you're seeing sprout up, so look, they're, MSNBC and Fox have a business model, and good for them. So they want to have partisan coverage of the news. It's a mix of opinion, mostly opinion, a little bit of news. And if they want to do that, that's fine. Where I get a little discouraged is when I hear the term partisan journalism, right? To me, that's an oxymoron. If you're doing journalism, it should, by definition, be nonpartisan. It doesn't mean that partisan journalism doesn't have characteristics of journalism and that journalists aren't practicing. It doesn't mean there's anything wrong with it. It doesn't mean that it's not a viable thing to do. But if you're doing something from a partisan viewpoint, if you're only writing negative stories on the governor or positive stories on the mayor, and that's the only thing you do, well, then you're not really doing journalism. You're doing something else. It has characteristics of journalism. There might even be individual stories within your platform that would pass as completely balanced. But overall, if it's a point of view, it's not journalism, which is a terribly important distinction other than if it's squeezing out what I would call real journalism, that's not a good thing. And so preserving truly nonpartisan journalism, I think, is a vital mission for the Republic. Let's face it, there's no shortage of partisan outlets for you to get information, right? If you're having trouble finding any, just let me know. I can direct you to the right way. But there is increasingly, I mean, so what would you identify, don't say it out loud, but just in your head, as a truly nonpartisan news outlet? And my guess is we'd get a few different answers, but they're not as easy to come up with as if I asked you the inverse question, and I think you could rattle them off one after the other. So it's a problem, not because there's something wrong with those, but because if we don't preserve truly nonpartisan journalism, it's, I think, dangerous to the republic.
Well, you know, it's an interesting point because there are some studies. There is not a lot of research into what happens to communities when they lose their local news sources, but there is research that looks at what's happening to communities that are becoming more polarized, and what they've concluded is many of those communities have lost their news sources. So, for example, there is a study out of the University of Texas that looked at when they wanted to find out why are some local communities becoming more partisan. Even if they're like nonpartisan races, people are voting along. There's less split ticket voting, and their conclusion was in those communities there is less coverage of local news. So what happens is when there is more coverage of local government, people learn about, you know, this city commissioner. I agree with him some of the time. I agree with him, you know, I disagree with him some of the time. But he's not in my party. So, you know what? There's somebody from another party that I can agree with some of the time. When you lose that, you lose the ability to kind of moderate and understand where the middle is. And that's where there's research that shows that there's more split ticket voting in communities that have lost their local newspaper. There's less voter engagement, which means that because there's less coverage of local government, so people are like, they don't care. It's really having an effect. I mean, we the loss of local news is having a direct effect on how people view their government.
You know, balance in news is by definition reaching out for contrary information, right? Who's doing that in our society right now? It's the opposite. It's the echo chamber. And if you disagree with me, it's shameful, right? You should be ashamed for having this view where 50% of the people think one way or the other, right? I mean, it's like amazing that we're so willing to just cast aside tens of millions of people. And so, you know, journalism helps identify both sides of issues. And when you lose that, man, it just really oversimplifies things and leads to shouting, not thinking.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, the victory is always like, you know, we would say in the newsroom, like, you want everyone to be mad at you, right? Like, and you don't want anyone to be mad at you, but, you know, you want the developer that you're writing the story about their development that's, you know, causing all these environmental problems, and the neighbors who are, you know, community is being destroyed by this, to both read that article and feel that they were fairly represented. And to me, that is what we're supposed to be doing every day, and that's our standard of that, so that they know that they were heard. And that's what I think local journalism can do really well, and because we do know what people in our community. So, you know, it's like, shame on us if we don't try. Shame on them if we give them an opportunity and neither side wants to play. I mean, there's been a million times my phone is rung and people have been angry that I had the other side in the story. And I'm like, well, hey, I'm sorry, but that's kind of the way this works. Like, but I think that people have expectations about it. But I think particularly now it's really important. It seems really simple. But I think when we see it in our news coverage, we ought to applaud it and we ought to be happy to see it and kind of reward it and hold it up as, remember, this is what it's supposed to look like, because we don't see a lot of it right now. And I want to go back to one quick thing on the revenue piece. You know, I was just reading a Ken Doctor's thing today that you sent me, Skip, about the 20 things. And it was very long. I didn't read it all. about looking ahead, 2020, looking ahead at, like, big things are going to be happening in the industry. And, you know, in companies like the New York Times, they are killing it right now. They are making a ton of money, and they are making a lot of money on their subscription model. And so, you know, this has always been, and as Mary Ellen was saying before, and I'll shut up because I'm a moderator, but I have lots of thoughts, is that, you know, we didn't have to worry about that in the newsroom. Like, we just wanted to write stories, fair stories, do investigations, explain the community. You know, increasingly, newsrooms carry the burden of subscriptions. And, I mean, that's just a realistic thing. If you read Jeff Berlew's stuff or Netta's stuff, you know, we put little things in there, please subscribe. I mean, that's, like, for real. Like, that's how that's going to work. Like, you know, like, why does the New York Times seem to be everywhere and how so robust and people are loving their stuff is because they have hired scads of reporters and they're making a lot of money based on subscriptions. So, like, we all kind of bear some responsibility to that, and that's my piece on that. So, amid all of this bleakness, where do we go? What does local journalism look like going forward with this massive consolidation that just happened with our paper? And
Go ahead.
Well, it's one of those times disruption creates experimentation. And so there's a lot of models out there that are trying to do something new. We've got, a lot of niche journalism where, locally people start up something and they're just going to focus on City Hall. There's many things all across the country, but the one thing that is pretty constant is there's not a lot of money behind any of it in terms of commercial. So most of it is not for profit. Now, there's a model that seems to be the most effective, and that is something that's been around for a really long time, and that's the public radio model, which is, it's non-profit, it's subscription, but it also takes some philanthropy, foundation money, and then sponsors, which is like classic advertising, but they don't call it advertising. That's kind of this hybrid model. The Texas Tribune is doing that pretty successfully. Then there's like the billionaire benefactors that have, Jeff Bezos buys the Washington Post. Right. The Washington Post turns itself around and is killing it. You've got, the LA Times has a billionaire. The Minneapolis Star and Tribune has a billionaire owner. And now the Philadelphia Inquirer has a billionaire. So
is anybody here billionaire?
Right, because we'll take a billionaire.
Billionaires, raise your hand, please. Raise
benevolent
your hand.
Dictators will take them.
Okay, shoot.
You know what? Do you think you could do it with less than a billion?
Probably.
100 billionaires, raise your hand.
Yeah. Anyway,
never works.
Yeah, that's kind of where we are on things. Now, the nonprofit model is an interesting one. We'll see, the hope is that people can start these and then they sustain themselves after they've been given some foundation money for a while. But I think we're in this uncertain place. I don't think journalism is going to disappear. It's just going to be funded differently.
Right, and maybe in pockets. I don't know. I mean,
and maybe in niches.
Right. Yeah. I mean, the there was just a story today. Some women left the Texas Tribune. Now they started this kind of women-focused enterprise. They're going to be on the Washington Post platform for the next 6 months or so. Mm-hmm. $5 million. They're going to hire 17 people. They're going to cover U.S. Capitol News, looking at women and gender issues. That's great. Now, that's not really going to help us in Tallahassee.
Yeah.
So you wonder how that works. I mean, right now the grand experiment is the mega merger, and there's still room for the mega mergers because,
The scary thing to me is that in 2004, 1 out of 8 journalists were in New York, L.A., or D.C. 10 years later, it was 1 out of 4. So that basically shows that the concentration of journalists and where it's working is places like D.C. Mm-hmm. So rather than choosing, their model wasn't to choose a regional focus like Texas. Right. Their model was to go to D.C. and look for the national focus on the niche of gender reporting. I think that's great, but that doesn't do a lot for our local, what we're talking about here. And hopefully we can find a way to find and make it commercially successful, bringing up the local journalism that we all value.
Right. I mean, I think that, no one has cracked the code for local legacy newspapers on how to make that make money. I think that just on the real normal, local level is the new company, the new Gannett, is, saying publicly that they aren't going to be not firing reporters or editors. Hopefully, that's a good thing. But we know that there will be lots of people who lose their jobs, in other parts of that industry.
Liz is gesticulating wildly
at me. Well, and I have very bad vision, so you have to be a little bit more bold.
Tell me what
bold.
That meant.
Well, can we take questions soon?
I thought we were interacting.
Let's bring up, Bob and Steve.
Yeah, what goes on next?
Well, actually, hold on.
Can you hear me?
Yeah. Yes.
So actually, I do have a question that's relevant to your conversation about the business model.
Okay.
So what percentage of income is sent up to the parent company? I have read that the Wall Street investors buying local papers and taking out as much money as possible is another huge factor in killing local papers. And I actually have a second part to that that I wonder about is there a model where the community can support part of a newspaper that has corporate ownership?
Is there a model where the...
So in other words, so there's a nonprofit model and there's corporate ownership. Is there any kind of split where, like, we in the community can make sure that, you know, that there are more journalists or, you know, whatever?
Well, the answer to the first question is Gannett and McClatchy are publicly traded companies, right?
At this point.
So they have stockholders of varying sizes and like every other publicly traded company that you frequent, they're responsible for a certain level of profit. I mean, it's just kind of business 101 there. So newspapers aren't any different than McDonald's or Ford or anybody like that. In terms of the hybrid solution, I don't know.
Well, the Salt Lake City Tribune did something.
Converted, yeah.
This is, to me, the future. So McClatchy, when I started, I don't know what their shares were trading at, but they were a lot more than they are today. When McClatchy told the federal government a couple weeks ago that it would not, that it's worked out an agreement because it doesn't have the money to pay for its pension obligation, its next pension obligation. So it worked out an agreement with the federal government to sort of figure out a reorganization plan. Well, we don't know what that's going to look like yet, but because of that news, the McClatchy stock doubled. And it went from 6 cents to 12 cents a share. This, to me, is a sign that this company doesn't need to be, you know, it's almost bottomed out.
Yeah.
So what the Salt Lake City Tribune did is its owners bought out the remaining shares, and they asked the IRS if they could become nonprofit. And even though they thought that this IRS was going to be very antagonistic towards media, and they thought it was going to take 10 years or 3 years for this decision to come down, the decision came down in 3 months, and they were allowed to become a nonprofit. So now the Salt Lake City Tribune is a not-for-profit, and it can, instead of giving all it, you know, what's left of its profits to some shareholders and family members, they can reinvest it. Now, they still have to become successful and profitable, and they cannot do endorsements of candidates anymore. But, you know, hey, that's a trade-off.
Yeah, that's no big deal.
No, but, I mean, I saw that, and that is like you think
that's
maybe that's the way, you know? Because part of the thing that has been always difficult when you are a newspaper under corporate ownership is that, you know, it's the year-over-year gains, you know. And back when we were printing money, that was no problem. But now, you know, it is not realistic. And so, you know, while we still make money, we don't make enough money. And you can never get ahead of that boulder. Yeah. And so...
Another question?
So another question related to this. So, Skip, if you get your billionaire here tonight...
Yes.
Okay. if they're being kind of quiet so far, that with a trend towards ownership like that, how do you keep the nonpartisan, independent nature of the newspaper instead of it being slanted toward the view of the owner?
Well, you don't accept money from people who want to put their finger on the scale. So you either say, I'm fine with, you know, operating a news outlet on the whims of a probably, you know, eccentric billionaire, because they're all eccentric, right? How did that work? There's no, like, boring billionaires. They're all eccentric. Or you say, hey, you need to treat journalism like a performing art, And we sustain the arts because it's important to our society, and we sustain journalism because it's vital to our republic. You know, when it comes to supporting it financially, I have no doubt that if a billionaire walked in, bought the Tallahassee Democrat, hired me back to be the publisher of a nonpartisan, now for-profit organization, and we needed community support, you know, in this room, we'd have a pretty high percentage of people willing to pay $100 a year, $500 a year to keep local journalism going. The problem, as we surfaced at a meeting we had prepping for this, is that those kids, as I stand out on my lawn shaking my newspaper, are a little less eager, to put it charitably, to pay for, you know, much of anything, and in particular, news content. Mm-hmm. So presumably these young folks walk into Chick-fil-A and just demand free sandwiches. No, I'm teasing. So that is actually a real thing, right? The younger set, I mean, and we see this all the time, and it's just so astonishing when somebody posts on Facebook, why did you post this on Facebook if you're going to make me go pay for the story? You know, as if all these reporters are just magically, you know, harvesting their salaries off of the magic tree of money. And so, you know, we've got to find a way to make sure young folks understand the core importance of journalism to the republic. Some people don't buy that. They think that's ridiculous and that the republic will be just fine.
Well, there's another option, and that is, the guys that made this work, that, you know, we're the producers of the content, but all the content's going on Google, it's going on Facebook, mm-hmm. it's going on Twitter. And is Twitter, Facebook, and Google paying us for that content? No. What are they doing? They are tracking what you're reading, how much you're reading, how often you're reading, and they're sending you the ads of all the stuff you just had a conversation with somebody on your cell phone that, you know, you're talking about going to a movie, now you're seeing the movie ads, or you're talking, you know, right. they're watching you. They're watching everything about you, and they're not giving us any money for that content. So maybe that's where we, you know,
right.
maybe there's a need to regulate, ask the platforms to own up a little bit, right. You know.
And part of the thing to the initial question was, I mean, it's about transparency. I mean, you don't have people who insist on having editorial control, but you also be very incredibly transparent about where all your money is coming from. I mean, you put their names on it so that there can be no, you know, gotchas about it. But
yeah, mm-hmm. That's a good point.
Okay. I have a question from a fellow young person in the audience. It's not me. Someone else. What do you think journalism needs from the next generation of writers, and how can we help to save the industry?
Needs from the next generation of writers?
Yeah, needs.
Okay.
Does journalism need?
All I can say, first I will say, anybody who is a young person going into journalism deserves, like, hero status. You know, for somebody who wants to, they want to do it because they want to do it. It's not because they see that there's giant future ahead of them. There's no certainty. So all I can say is if somebody who wants to go and is young and is in journalism, they have my great respect.
Mm-hmm. More than ever, incredibly thick skin. Let me tell you, and I'm not saying it for pity, it's rough. And, you know, I look around at the journalists that I worked with. I finally got the past tense in there. And they are some of the finest people I know that get some of the most terrible things said about them that you can imagine. I'm not talking about criticism, even deserved criticism or undeserved. I'm talking about hateful, threatening, awful things. It's why the Democrat has always been a partner with Village Square, because it's promoting the type of discourse that we need more of. You can play a role there, because I know every single one of you has seen it somewhere on Facebook or social media. And even if we did something knuckleheaded, which we have, will, and are going to keep doing because we're, you know, human beings, step in and give these guys the benefit of the doubt, okay? Step in and give them the benefit of the ideological doubt, of the, you know, inaccuracy doubt, of judgment, all the kind of mistakes that we're susceptible to. But if you're not willing to be abused, and I mean, that's not an exaggeration, then you're not ready to be a journalist.
Ouch. It's okay, really, if you want to do it.
I've got three children, and I know exactly which one could do it and which ones couldn't. And, I mean, look, it's a real thing, and you can help. You can help. And not just with journalists, but all the other, you know, political leaders and all the other people that are getting hated. But there's certainly, you know, we're right up there with umpires and lawyers and, you know, people like that.
I would say also, just real quick to the young person, because I think I know the young person who asked that question. Hi, young person.
Oh, sorry, young person.
Is that I work with a lot of young journalists who have just started, and these journalists are smarter than I ever was. I mean, they're just so bright and together. And, like, I'm like, whoa, you're going to be so amazing. I'm glad I'll be dead when you're so great. Like, so it's incredibly inspiring to be around them. They know a lot. Every day we work with so many cool young reporters. The other thing is, though, I think young reporters need to be professionals. Like, do your homework. I mean, you know, keep your copy clean and know how to write a sentence and use strong verbs. And, you know, like, be a faithful carrier of the written word, because that's what you're doing. So, I mean, because that's where the only place I can fault them, really. You know, not fault them, but, you know, I'm like, boy, you get to write this stuff. Like, be into the writing. So that would be my advice.
Well, also, reflect your generation, because we need to be writing for it.
Yep.
So here's a two. Can you hear me? Here's a two-parter, and then after that, you can invite the rest of our panel up. Is it inevitable that you get these great young cub reporters, and that they'll want to leave local journalism? And how do you keep them? And the second part, this is progress on your billionaire. Somebody wants to know exactly, if there were a benefactor here in this room, financially, give us an estimate, what would it take to support the newspaper?
No, I don't know the answer to that one.
I don't think they...
Yeah, I wouldn't presume to... See me afterward.
You said 100 million.
100 million.
Yeah, see me in the...
see skip after.
Paul, what was the first one again?
The first one was, you've got these wonderful young reporters. Is it inevitable that we lose them? How do we keep them?
Yeah, well, that's a constant issue. I mean, that's not necessarily a function of the business realities or the current business realities. That's something that's faced newspapers and lots of other businesses for a long time. You know, bigger jobs are in bigger cities, generally speaking. So you either get promoted where you are, or you jump to a bigger place, right? You jump, if you work at Wells Fargo, well, they got a big, you know, branch in Charlotte, a big headquarters there. And so that's always a thing. And you're just basically, you know, that it's, do individuals care enough about, you know, care so much about the community they want to stay, or are they ambitious and want to make more money? Maybe they didn't have any ties to the community in the first place. So I don't think that's as much tied to the business realities as it is.
Yeah, you know. I also think, you know, when you're in a smaller community, there's more of a give and take, and you know the people you're covering, which you actually, it makes it easier for you to be fair. It's more fun when you have an impact. So one of the best things about being in a smaller place is you actually can't, you know the impact that you have. And if you're in it because you can make a difference, you can see the difference you can make. You write for a bigger news organization. You're one, you know, one little fish in a giant pond. So it depends on what you want out of it. If my hope is that people will want to stay because you can, in a smaller place, you can have a bigger impact.
Right. I mean, and you want some of them. You don't want everyone to stay because not everyone should stay. I mean, you know, there are some that the place really resonates with them, and that's, you know, where they, you know, I've spent long chunks of time in, you know, two communities because I really got into that. I love that part. But there are ones, you want them to go on, you know. Got to bring in new people. They need to move on, spread their wings. I mean, it's a wonderful thing to be able to see people like, go off, little dove, fly, you know? That's awesome. But, you know, the ones who stay in communities do become the bedrock, I think, of communities, and we are very fortunate here at this newspaper to have some of those people who have been here for decades, and it really helps the quality of the work. Oh, and I'm inviting up. So it's time for me to invite Bob Sanchez and Steve Stewart up to the conversation.
Where's Bob?
Nope. Hey, Steve. Welcome.
Still can't get this thing.
Oh, hey, I'm sorry. I am not really know how I'm supposed to do this.
If I get up, my little ear thing will fall off.
Yeah, exactly. I'm kind of tied to this thing. So you guys have been listening. You guys were sort of here to round out our panel and, you know, a slightly different perspective here. Steve is the publisher of Tallahassee Reports, which focuses on Tallahassee city government, sort of in this niche idea that we've been talking about. Bob has just been around forever and ever and knows this industry, you know, in and out, and has survived it and seen it all. So I guess I will throw it open maybe to you, Steve, first, you know, some thoughts on what this conversation's been.
Yeah, well, my first thought is I'm really concerned about Jeff Berlew sitting next to the U.S. attorney. So wondering about that. No, you know, this is, it's been a journey. Actually, I'm the editor. My wife is the publisher.
Okay, I'm sorry.
That's fine. And so, you know, we started this as a blog in 2009, and I was sort of involved with, I've known Mary Ellen for a number of years, with the Public Service Commission at the state level, sort of where I adopted this watchdog mentality. And so as I watch the news media change, it's, you know, it's exciting from my vantage point. I understand from the legacy media it is depressing. And, you know, for the record, I subscribe to the Tallahassee Democrat. I encourage you to subscribe to Tallahassee Reports. I think that where we're moving is that local news is going to be provided by a lot of different outlets. I mean, if you read, there's a lot of stuff, and Mary Ellen has studied this, but there's a lot of people who write about this and what's happening across the country. We became a nonprofit in 2015 because, I mean, there's a group called Institute for Nonprofit News, 150, 200 members, and it's growing. And that sort of is the model that where it's going. But there's a lot of different obstacles on the way. I mean, what Skip talks about is something we don't have to do is the Tallahassee Democrat has to cover everything because they are the paper of record. And I'm glad they have to do that. I don't want to do that. We focus on local government, school board, city, Leon County Commission, and we cover the business community, business statistics. And so that's sort of our focus. And so I'm excited about the future and the opportunities to get the news out there. I think there's a number of things that have to change within the news industry. I think, first of all, and again, I respect journalists immensely. The problem is, and this is coming from a free market guy, capitalism has ruined journalism. And it's because journalism, for the most part, is a public good. If you go back and look, John Collins started the Tallahassee Democrat back in the mid-1800s. It was owned by individuals in the community until 1965. And that's what it's going to boomerang back to. You know, the money, Gannett, we're shipping money. Our eyeballs are shipping money out of town. They're not choosing to do this, but that's because they're corporately owned. And that was a choice made in the 60s and 70s. And now they can't really send the amount of money that they're looking for. So now they're sort of, obviously, they're cutting resources. So I think from that standpoint, it's going to change. It has to change because it's not working. And I think it's going to be, it's not my thought, it's what I'm reading, is that you're going to get local news from WFSU, from Taos Reports, from the Taos Democrat, from other outlets. My issue is I think we should work together. I call it competitive collegiality. I think we have to be competitive in what we cover. Everybody wants to break the story or wants to do the, you know, the investigative reporting. But I think together as local media, we need to provide each other the credibility. And this has happened on occasions. You know, Taos Reports has been cited, you know, across the state, Tampa Bay Times, Orlando Sentinel, Miami Herald, Washington Post, and yes, Taos Democrat. And I think what they were talking earlier about the state level where people would jump in on stories, we would go, and I'm really focused on just local news. There's other, I've seen the problems nationally in the state, and I don't want to deal with those. But from a local news perspective, I think it really can be done. You almost need a Tallahassee Press Association, and you need to be competitive but collegial at the same time. And so I'm excited about it. It's going to be, I think, a bumpy road. We're growing, but we started with nothing, you know. So I mean, it's easy to grow, and we are using we're using interns from FSU to do some reporting. We have ex-reporters that work on the side; they're not full-time employees. But, you know, technology has made it easier to cover a lot of these meetings. And so that helps also. But I'm very focused on trying to help the media in Tallahassee grow and be responsive because, you know, what we've gone through in the last 10 years here locally, I think, you know, it's a reflection of sort of the community, unfortunately. But I think it's something we don't want to happen again. And I think that a very aggressive, credible, and competent media will stop that from happening. And so anyway, I'm looking forward to the next 10 to 15 years.
Bob, what's your perspective on the local scene?
Well, one thing is that the local news is not necessarily partisan, as some speakers have pointed out. As some candidates have pointed out, fixing a pothole is not necessarily a partisan issue.
Right.
I think Liz wanted us on the panel because to represent young people.
we were going to diversify the panel.
My bad. Conservatives. Okay, conservatives. Well, one thing I think a lot of us focus on the national media, the cable networks, the national newspapers, and so forth. And one thing I wanted to mention was that I think a sad fact of life is that some conservatives are not lamenting the disruptions in the news media. Mm-hmm. In fact, they're kind of gleeful about it. And my point would be, well, why would that be true? Well, of course, you have people like Rush Limbaugh referring to the mainstream media or the drive-by media. You have that alt-right lunatic who's on the same station as Steve Stewart, Alex Jones, who denies the existence of the school massacre in Connecticut and mm-hmm. so forth, deriding the media. The question is, why does that resonate so much among some conservatives?
Right.
And I think there's a perception among conservatives that the national media in particular, notwithstanding Fox News and talk radio, the national media as a whole, including the New York Times and Washington Post and the major TV networks, lean to the left. Mm-hmm. And they may not even realize they do. As they say, fish don't know they're swimming in water. I'm reminded of, I was attending a seminar at Columbia a few years ago, and we had a break, so I went out to walk around those little news kiosks that you see in the old movies. Used to have all the tabloids displayed. There were only a couple of papers there, but they still have postcards. And there was a cartoon depiction of Manhattan Island, and all the territory to the left of it was labeled unexplored territory. And to some extent, that's what the people who fly back and forth from Madison Avenue in Manhattan mm-hmm. to Hollywood and back call the flyover zone.
Right.
And sometimes they refer to the residents of the flyover zone with certain contempt. Or they're clinging to their faith and their guns and so forth.
Right.
So I think there was some of that involved. It was one reason it resonated. The other question is, how did it get so bad so quickly?
Right, that's what I was going to ask you. Like, how?
Well, I brought a prop, which I left in my car. But It was the last edition of the Miami News, Miami's oldest newspaper. It was December 31st, 1988. And the headline across the top, Farewell Miami. And that left the Miami Herald, where I worked, as the only paper in town. Now, did the Herald see this as a harbinger, a canary in the coal mine for things to come? No, the attitude was, wow, we got the whole town to ourselves now, all the advertising, all that sort of stuff. And as it continued to grow in the 90s, the publisher decided we needed a new press that was larger and faster, and I believe they spent $150 million to put a new, faster press in the Herald because it was always going to be up. But quickly, when I retired in 2000, I took early retirement from the Herald to become a spokesman for a state agency. The circulation was teetering around 500,000. Now it's teetering around 100,000. A lot of clicks online because a lot of foreign visitors, especially, or people planning to visit Florida, they think Miami and Florida are the same thing. Mm-hmm. But and the Herald is very clever at writing headlines that are good clickbait. I think their favorite punctuation mark is the ellipsis.
We like colons too, you know, report.
Yeah. So anyway, I think for various reasons, it's kind of ironic. The pundits and publishers whose favorite auxiliary verbs was must, ought to, and should, didn't see it coming in their own industry.
Well, do you think the lack of competition has driven some of that hyper-partisanship, or I guess I kind of lost the...
Well, I think one bit of collateral damage was this consolidation you've spoken about, mm-hmm. of ownership. And quite often, the headquarters of these corporations... were back in one of those places like New York,
right,
or Washington, right, where their news operations were.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, there's no doubt in my mind that the reason this industry is in the bad shape it's in is because newspaper men are terrible businessmen, and if they had any idea. In the 90s, when the internet arrived, they could have preceded Facebook and Google by saying, "Wow, if people start reading our stories, we can track what they read. We can get their data and sell their data." They had no idea what they had in front of them. So here we are. So I'm not necessarily saying that doesn't mean that the next generation can't reinvent something and be successful. But I think Steve is right in that the future is going to be more niches. We're going to have the sports sites that deliver news for the people who want sports, and fashion for fashion, and gossip for those that like dirt. But the challenge is, who wants to go to a website that's just about government? Is the hardest challenge.
Well, I think on that point, because we started covering the city pretty heavily, and that's sort of a question that we've mm-hmm. come up with, is when we start that. But you start thinking about local government, and we're trying to grow, and we see what people read, and back to Skip's point, it's about 350 words is about the max, and people quit reading. But we started saying, well, wait a minute, we're just covering the city. How many people can just be interested in the city? We started thinking about the school board with, here in Leon County, you have 33,000 kids in school. That's 33,000 households. So the school board, I think, and this is not a critique, but I think for whatever reason, resources has been undercovered in this community a great deal because there is so much going on. I mean, you look at all the schools and you look at the meetings, you look at everything that's going on. And so you have to think about those things that you're going to cover that draw interest. And we have found that is, next to the corruption that we covered in City Hall was the school board, some just very moderate stories that you're just reporting is get a lot of traffic. And so that's a very interesting dynamic. So I think, but you're right, it's from a niche standpoint. We do a print newspaper, and we put a page in there with mostly FSU sports. Just again, back to Skip's point, trying to give a little bit to everyone. But everything you read is you can't be everything to everybody anymore. I mean, that's the way it used to be, the crossword puzzle of comics and the classifieds. And it's going to be more niche. And that's where it becomes, if you're more niche, you can be more, you can provide more quality because you're just focused on that. And, you know, there's all kind of Facebook pages and websites that are covering, like, food. I mean, do you really need to, and again, this is not hitting on one thing. It's sports is the same way. I mean, how many sites cover FSU sports? It's got to be at least three, and I think two of them don't charge. And that's just ones to generate from Tallahassee. You get nationally, and there's more stuff. So there's a lot of people interested, but it is a saturated market. So again, I think what we're trying to do is it's not pretty all the time, and you don't make a lot of friends. I can attest to that. But it's the journalism that needs to be done. And like we said up here on the panel, there are kids that I work with coming out of FSU that are doing this for the right reasons. There's so much negativity in the legacy media and the future of journalism. You try to convince them, look, it's going to be different, and you need to be ready for that, and this is what's possible.
Yeah, Bob.
Yeah, in one respect, Tallahasseans are very local because the structure of government, of local government here, is very different from some Florida counties. In Miami-Dade County, there are 31 municipalities, mm-hmm. including some of the most corrupt imaginable. These local officials are elected in elections where there you may be lucky to have 10% of the voters turn out.
Right.
And it is just a mess. And that is more than the Miami Herald can cover, even though it has more resources
right.
than the Tallahassee Democrat. It has one city, one county, one school board,
right.
and a few other things to cover, plus, like every paper, state government.
Well, I think one of the things, though, too, is clearly these niche things, you know, you can get $5 million here to start your niche to get hold down this little piece of it. I mean, part of the beauty of legacy newspapers and even on websites is you run across stuff that's surprising, that you didn't know you were looking for. And I hope that as this evolves, that there's room for that discovery in how we consume our media. Because I, who read a lot of news now, still love to be surprised by a great life story or a, you know, because not everything should be, I, Jennifer, am seeking out, you know, the best brand of comfortable shoes. So there, you know, and I want to find out exactly what happened at that debate. Like, no, like, I think it's important that we have experience the world, and it's not always just what I want right now. It's what I can run into and can be surprised by.
So there's a Harvard professor who studied this, and he's basically, what we have lost is serendipity. You don't open the newspaper and accidentally see a story about something you never had intended to see, because it is these algorithms that are curating what your favorite things are, and they're delivering it to you without, and you have no idea how they're coming up with that formula, but they're sending it to you, and it's all in some big black box, and you will never know. And if you know, until we get to the point where we have the kind of self-discipline that says we got to go outside of that box, mm-hmm. We're going to continue to be fed exactly everything that confirms our biases, our weaknesses, and potentially our strengths. But it's not us that is making the choice.
Right.
It makes it really bad when you accidentally click on like a beet recipe or something on, and all of a sudden it's like beets are in your timeline all the time. I didn't like that. Make it go away. How do you un-algorithm yourself? We need to. Maybe that's a bit startup company.
No kidding.
Do you have a question, Liz?
So here's sort of a related question: how does the Democrat decide their editorial stances? Was the decision to not endorse candidates related to financial concerns? And then throwing into that is, you know, aren't there risks to this the niche markets and the siloization that you're not sort of having the editorial process that's a part of a more major news source?
So on our editorial, the way that works is I came up with an idea, Jennifer shouted it down, and we decided just to not write anything on it. I'm not joking. That's exactly how it went.
Yeah. Actually, Jeff just walked by me and looked at me knowingly when you said that.
On endorsing candidates, that was my thing. I think it's I have always believed that really a two-prong objection. I think it's arrogant and presumptuous. And I think it ties our wagon to political leaders for better and usually for worse. And I don't want to be stuck with people that we endorse. And so we haven't done that. I'm no longer the we. So I don't know what William and his team are going to decide to do. Doesn't sound like they're going to change it. Once you go there, it's a really nice place to be because it drives us toward our mission of focusing on issues, not people. So we had a very robust pre-election editorial board set up where even at statewide offices, we went really deep. And you could see that since they weren't trying to, you know, get our endorsement or not get it, depending on what they really wanted, we really got some amazing information out of those and sometimes some pretty robust, to put it charitably, discussions. So, and no, nothing about finance has had anything to do with any editorial we wrote. I appreciate the question, but that is very, very far from
Bob,
the truth.
Or it was more specifically, did you stop endorsing because of financial issues? In other words,
heavens,
resources.
No.
Bob?
And I somewhat disagree with his decision not to endorse for this reason. At least it may depend on the size of the market you're serving. In Miami-Dade County, there were dozens and dozens of offices especially for judgeships.
So it would help people.
And it was sort of like restaurant reviews and other things. We did have the candidates fill out questionnaires. We brought them in for interviews. We checked to see whether the Bar Association had recommended them or not and who else was for them or against them for various reasons. And so it may be different for judges and their legislators. There were like 20 different legislative seats in Dade County for the House and 9
right.
or 10 for the Senate. So we knew people wouldn't care whom we endorsed for president. They probably had their mind made up.
Right.
Although they might want to know, well, what do you people think about it?
Right.
But and for governor and cabinet offices, we did endorse for the most part. But
so we still did all of the questionnaires. We did the interviews. And then we would write editorials and we would say, here are their positions on major issues, and here's where we fall on those issues. So we were sometimes it was, you know, pretty obvious that we felt the same way as a certain candidate on all the issues. Most of the time, it was a mix of things, and we let people look. Reasonable people can disagree on this. I understand fully what the argument is for endorsing candidates. I think that's a reasonable view. It just doesn't happen to be my view.
Constitutional amendments also. It's very helpful. Mm-hmm. Sometimes,
yeah.
And sometimes the discussion happens.
Yeah, we did do constitutional amendments because that wasn't attaching ourselves to a person.
And then after they pass, you try to figure out what they mean.
Well,
Marcy's Law, felons
that's
voting, and so forth.
Full of wax.
Liz? So how did the AP and UPI work, and could that system be revived? I mean, it's still around.
Bob?
Well,
I didn't understand the question. Go ahead.
Oh.
We actually use a new service for
new
state
coverage.
New service
of Florida?
Yeah, new service of Florida, which is, for a nonprofit, is very reasonable. And it's we get to pick the stories of professional journalists, and it adds a lot of credibility to what we do. And, you know, that's one of the things I don't understand. I know that the UPI, I guess, is that still around, UPI?
UPI is gone.
Yeah.
Yeah.
AP is, I know, is still used, but that's sort of what you have with the news service of Florida. You've got like what, 8 journalists maybe that are writing about state areas, you know, are covering everything in the
state.
They just
cover state issues.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's not a lot of investigative stuff. It's more just news of the day, but it's very in-depth articles.
Well, and I think when you see a company like New Gannett, you've got now 265 papers. The AP starts becoming more and more. Not super relevant because if you
right.
are plucking content from El Paso and Colorado Springs, and I've got a reporter there, right, all of a sudden. So, you know, the New Gannett has paper in 49 states now. So,
yeah, AP's in big trouble. It's a member-supported organization. So as the membership suffers, so does the Associated Press. I mean, it's paid for by legacy newspapers for the most part and TV. And then Jennifer makes a great point. If you don't think Gannett is going to look at that, you know, expense and say, wow, we could become the new AP, get rid of that expense, and then start charging other papers and turn it into a revenue stream, that seems like a pretty obvious business strategy. So certainly not giving away any.
Yeah, I don't have any proprietary information there. It's just, I mean, you can just look upon the landscape.
So I think AP is in big trouble.
And is Reuters basically the same model?
Well, it's more of an international thing, so I don't. That's I don't know about that.
And business wire. Yeah.
Well, so Skip, you had actually said that the Texas Tribune has a model that provides stories downstream to local, right?
Has a model that...
Well, essentially, they provide some content to local newspapers,
well,
correct?
There are lots of nonprofit news organizations sprouting up of various size. ProPublica has been around in Minnesota forever, one of the really first kind of nonprofit news outlets. We've got here the news service, which Steve mentioned. There's Florida Phoenix, which is one of those kind of partisan outlets. There's Sunshine State News, which is the right-wing version of the counterpart to the Florida Phoenix. So there's various models. Most of them are free. Most of them are openly share their content. And so, you know, we'll have to see. There's a lot of kind of new growth there. Does it reach a scale that changes the face of American journalism? You know, we'll just have to see about that. I certainly hope it does, and you know, not or, but and that for-profit journalism finds its footing and a renaissance as well. So that answer your question? I'm sure Steve has something to say about that.
Well, no, I wanted to comment real quick on the partisan. I know we talked in the meeting about how the partisan divide at the national level affects local news, and I wanted to comment that on just briefly, because one of the things, you know, we've been referred to as a conservative newspaper, and that is sort of, when you start getting those buzzwords, it's, you know, they're labels, and it bothers me from the sense that, you know, I don't watch cable news. You know, I read, I get online for the stuff nationally that I want to get. I go to the New York Times, Wall Street Journal. You can find the truth nationally if you really want it. But from a local perspective, I think it's very important because there is an effect here. When we post stories, it's, you know, people that are really tuned in and really driven by what's going on nationally, you could hit them with facts on local government. It wouldn't matter because, oh, that's that conservative newspaper or that's Steve Stewart. Or that's, you know, and it's the same thing on the other side. I'll give you a quick example. The Democrat had a great article last week by Carl Edders on an issue that's been a big issue here on lobbyists and vendors and campaign consultants. And it was well written, very in-depth. And so I shared it on my Facebook and gave a shout-out to the Democrat. And you see comments on there. It's coming from, you know, obviously some people that read Taos Reports, dismissing it right off the bat because it's the Tallahassee Democrat. And so I know how they feel because we get the same thing. And I think it's very important locally, and I'm asking you all to do this, is you don't look at the messenger. You can know the messenger. You can know the bias of the messenger. But look at the story and look at the credibility of the story. And I think that that's something that we're trying to do over the next couple of years is to make sure that people that write things that I don't want to use the word endorse it, but we follow up on it and give credibility to the people that maybe are just narrowed in to reading Taos Reports. So I think that's, again, one of the big impacts from the national, because there are people, it's scary. We did try from an opinion standpoint, I tried to do like a crossfire thing with a liberal candidate here on Facebook, on our newspaper. We did it for 3 months. It was useless. It was utterly useless. And it was more it brought in the national political dynamic. And on Facebook and on social media, it's amazing the things that people will say and what they will ignore. And so now we are just strictly local. We don't, you know, we just try to cover local. We do the news service for the state, but try to focus on local.
Bob.
Yeah, I think we'd be remiss. Everybody on the stage here has been associated with newspapers. But I think we'd be remiss if we don't also mention that broadcast television stations are also in trouble. You remember the final episode of MASH and some of these historic shows? 90% of the people were tuning in. Now you're lucky if a show is considered a hit if you get 5% of the audience. A lot of local TV stations, even in big cities like Jacksonville, have given up covering local news. Not that they cover it in as much depth as the print media did. But it's worth noting also, and it's so formulaic, it has to be visual. Some scholars at FSU could issue a 300-page scholarly report. It would be ignored. But if some morons scrawl a slogan on a placard and wave it in front of the old Capitol, the cameras will be there.
No, I know. It is true.
So, but as bad as it is, TV news at the local level is suffering as people go to other, and the kids are watching on their phones, listening to their playlist, all that sort of thing. So,
I wanted to, because we've been talking a lot about the Democrat editor, William Hatfield, is here tonight, and we wanted to give him just like a very quick minutes to...
Definitely minutes.
Hopefully not too tedious. He usually does move things right along. But wanted to give you an opportunity to kind of speak to some of these things.
Yeah, and I thank you guys so much. I mean, you know, this is a panel of some of the journalists I most respect in life. And as the editor of the Democrat and Tallahassee.com, I wanted to introduce you to some of the smartest, passionate people I know and embarrass them a little bit. Blessed to work with, serving the city. You know, we've talked a lot about the serious challenges that this industry faces. Those challenges are very real. The life-changing work these reporters and editors do in the face of those challenges each day is also very real. You know, I'm going to start with Jeff Berlew. Stand up, Jeff, just for a second. Our investigative reporter. And you guys can wait to clap at the end. Jeff's made it the Democrats' mission to tell the stories of homicide victims who these days often go unnamed by our police departments because of the interpretation of Marcy's Law. I mean, they literally cry out for justice from beyond the grave. He recently told us about John Dees, the Iraq war vet who's haunted by the scars of war, addiction, and was killed on Tallahassee streets. Carl Edders wanted to be here tonight. He's covering.
He's here.
He made it. covering the county commission meeting. He's the local government reporter who recently, along with Berlew, referenced by Steve, spent months investigating influence behind the scenes and questionable lobbying in local government. Jim Rossica, a Capitol Press Corps veteran and our new news director. He's coordinating the Capitol coverage for 17 newspapers and websites. Byron Dobson. Byron, you're behind me. You got to stand up. At least wave. He's our most veteran reporter who juggles the happenings at our higher ed institutions. Randy Atwood. She's our digital editor who also oversees the opinion page. She's also the Zingmeister. She's Zing. I shouldn't have said that. But you know what? She also wrote she wears a lot of hats. She landed the Democrat a $25,000 Facebook grant that is enabling us to continue Hurricane Michael recovery coverage in those hard-hit communities and news deserts. We have Kurt Wheeler, who serves all Seminole fans out there with relentless coverage. He's also a great Twitter play-by-play. James Call. He's our state worker advocate who just reported that the Senate president is including an across-the-board pay raise in his budget that will be released. We have Bill Cotterell, our Capitol curmudgeon. He has supervised lawmakers in Florida for more than a half century and written about their doings and dealings. John Kennedy is here. He is the second part of Journalism Power Couple and one of the most authoritative voices in Capitol coverage. Netta Hassanein, one of our best storytellers who took readers after Hurricane Michael to name and tell the stories of those who lost their lives in Hurricane Michael. Jeffrey Schwerz, maybe? There he is back there. He's our Capitol correspondent. Watchdog reporter, who along with Jeff Berlew told Tallahassee about questionable dealings and corruption at City Hall long before guilty pleas and settlements. These are the men and women who wake up each day.
The Democrats didn't have any reporters anymore.
They do, a little bit. You know, these are the men and women who wake up each day, face those challenges head on, in a mission to tell Tallahassee's story. And telling that story wouldn't be possible without all of you who support local journalism. And I just want to thank all of the subscribers, print, online, and both. It's not too late. Please join the subscriber fold. Thank you all for coming. Thank you for this important discussion.
Liz, our fearless leader.
Okay. Can you hear me? A couple of questions regarding the legislature. Please talk about the public notice bill. There's a bill in the legislature to eliminate the requirement for local governments to publish notices in the newspaper. What effects would this bill have on newspapers and government transparency? And then also, there's a move to reduce government in the sunshine that is a topic in this year's session. Please comment.
What was the last question?
Bad.
To reduce government in the sunshine. Oh.
So the public notices, I'll talk about that, and then anybody here can handle sunshine probably better than me. But public notices have been in newspapers and on their websites for many, many, many years. These are notices of government meetings, of zoning hearings, of tax changes and the like. Newspapers lobby very hard to keep these in newspapers because if you combine our print and digital reach, we are still by far have the greatest reach of any outlets that there are, and this is vital information to have, and because the last thing we need to do is put the government in charge of noticing its own meetings, lest they stick it on some site that you're never on, 19 links away from finding it, and nobody, the already too small participation in government becomes even more anemic at worst, I mean at best, and at worst, they just flat out hide things that they don't want you to know about so that there's no accountability. And so there are still many people, believe it or not, I bet a couple in this room that aren't on the internet or certainly aren't regularly, and so having our still significant print reach in addition to mandatory digital presence of legal ads is still vital. My guess is Steve has a different view on this.
No, it's that is something that helps, obviously, like legacy media. But I haven't, you know, I remember the bill's been up a couple of times, and I don't think it's anything that
I get real hot about. Well, it's also weekly papers, small papers. You know, the irony is I have never been in a legislative meeting where they don't print out the amendments and the text of the bills and the bill analysis in a binder presented to each of them before they vote on something. And as soon as they stop printing everything out, then we can stop printing out all the changes they want to do in law in our newspapers. They really are, we still are, want to see it in black and white. And until we move that direction, it doesn't make any sense.
Right.
On the Sunshine Law, and I don't know this from the state level, but the Sunshine Law, and this is something that I found out doing research in another job, but Florida, the Sunshine Law makes it so much easier for local journalists. I mean, one of the things that in Tallahassee that Tallahassee Reports has been spoiled with is the ease of getting information from the city and the county. It's amazing because when you start, I know I hear a lot of state reporters now complaining about how it takes months, which resembles more what I'm dealing with the school board now. But so that is a really important part of what we do in getting that information. And so I feel for the state reporters because one of the things during all this stuff with the city that we went through the last 10 years, they have professionals in the clerk's office. We would always get information. I never really felt that they were dodging anything on providing the information. Now, I will tell you, again, just a plug here. I don't have the 12 people to introduce, but the we did a story on the school board that is started a this refers to the Sunshine, started doing a Monday meeting before their Tuesday meeting. Which, and we actually, and I'm very proud of this journalism that we did. We wrote a story, and it turns out that 10 of those, they had 45 meetings. 10 of them, there is no record of anywhere. They didn't keep minutes. There's no audios and no video. Now, obviously, I would have loved to have follow-up on that. I even appealed to some state reporters to talk about it. Couldn't get anybody to write about it. And so I think, again, in the vein of the Sunshine, it's so important. That's one of the things we have locally is you can go to these meetings, you can get these documents. And for the city and county, it's been really, they've been really good at doing that.
Well, yeah, the only thing I was going to add is you know you're on to something they don't want when they start charging you for your public records request, right? It's like free, 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 free. That wouldn't be $5,000. Oh, well, you know, I wonder why. The other thing, and, you know, this gets back to corporate ownership, Gannett rolled the dice on an important lawsuit against the city to require them to start archiving text message right. and social media messaging of government employees, which the city eventually capitulated and signed a consent agreement and agreed to some checkup depositions along the way. You know, if we had lost that, then we would have owed thousands and thousands of dollars to attorneys. As it turns out, we won, and the city had to pay that. But that was an very important lawsuit because, you know, the plain reading of the public records law is, you know, just because you're texting somebody on government business, on a government phone, that's public record, right? That's just like sending an email. Well, the city of Tallahassee and virtually every other, maybe every other government in the city and county government in the state was not keeping any of right. those records. And so now there is precedent in this county, in this city at least, that is required. That's a big deal. And, you know, you just don't see newspapers filing lawsuits anymore, man. I run them up, used to run them up the flagpole, and it's a tough sell. But here was one where even the big, bad corporate owners did the right thing, so that was nice.
Right. Well, I think that, you know, we are really fortunate in Florida that we do have a broad public records law, and it's wonderful to be a reporter here, and other people in other states will tell you that, but it is constantly under attack. It is constantly being amended. It is forever being ratcheted down. Every year, more redactions. Marcy's Law is something that we're dealing with a lot right now. So, you know, that sort of that bright light is always they're trying to close it in like this. So that was a really great thing mm-hmm. where we actually saw something added to instead of taken away because there are more than 1,000 exemptions but to the public records law.
There's no penalties on this for violation of the Sunshine Laws. When we looked at the school
Very
board,
yeah.
you can't, I mean, unless you have the money to file a lawsuit and make a big deal about it, there are really no penalties,
yeah.
and as long as they correct it moving forward.
Right.
And so that's another issue.
Yeah, I mean, it's really important, but, you know, I would say, like, for it's not just for us reporter types, like, that's for all y'all, too. So, you know, I think that sometimes it becomes like, oh, well, whatever, you know, we feel bad about those poor journalists. Well, no, it's about all of us being able to get those records, and those records are important.
So last question, because we're at the end of the evening, and it's kind of a doubleheader. We talked about the nonprofit model for news. What about the very for-profit model for news? Do you have any comment on that? So that the efforts that are specifically very profit-oriented that are sort of rising from the, you know, that are not like corporate, but rising, like I guess they said Peter Schorsch. I don't
know. Oh, you mean pay to play?
Yeah.
And actually, okay. The doubleheader, so you can answer that. But then the other question is just what is the most important thing that you want this audience to know and to take home with them?
Can we just go there?
On the pay to play, this is something as someone who's breaking into journalism that I had to figure out, and it's a statewide problem. It hasn't really reared its head here. We're a nonprofit. All our finances are on our website. There's not a lot there, but you can go look. And certain donors, if we take a lot of money from donors, they show up there. But there is this underbelly side, which I wasn't sure how to – I started dealing with it during the campaign of Gillum and DeSantis because I wrote some stuff on the – you might have read on the race. But there are people that are really good at masking real journalism and doing pay for play, and they're taking money from elected officials, lots of money, and it's something that I don't know how you deal with it, because there's a number of them in the state, and Mary Ellen can talk more personal about it, but it's when I look at it from afar and what I figured out what they were doing, it's a mixture of, you know, having like an in-house politician right in the your journalist office paying you what to write, and then you mask that with some actual news, and it's people are good at it, and they make a lot of money on it. We don't do that. And again, the nonprofit requires you to provide your finances so you can see where the money comes from. Obviously, you see the advertising paper, but when you're a for-profit, that's something that is easy to hide, and it's not very transparent.
I think disclosure is one of the best disinfectants. And if you find a site that does not disclose who are their contributors, or how are they make their money, I think you have to raise some questions. So just like anything, discern the source. Right.
So yeah, if you're not familiar, this is FloridaPolitics.com, run by a guy named Peter Schwartz.
Address.
Yeah, well, and it's not just elected officials. It's
lobbyists
and companies that pay him, and he really manipulates the news. What? What was that?
Civility bell?
Civility?
What a piece. I guess you're not supposed to say that out loud.
No. I mean, he is very upfront about what he does.
He is. He says...
I'm not saying anything negative. I'm just saying the reality is that he accepts payment from various people and then kind of manipulates the news to be favorable to his paying clients on his site. And so it kind of looks like journalism. It's not journalism. It's a way to make a living. Good for him. Not criticizing it, just saying what it is.
So second half of the question.
I can't believe I got the civility bell.
Really?
Second half of the question, what is the most important thing that you want people in the audience to take with them tonight?
Bob, why don't you start?
Subscribe to the Democrat. Okay. Seriously.
The most important thing I'd like for people to understand is that local news is 90% nonpartisan. It's about government watchdog priorities and just getting information. And if we could just cut off the national ideology war when you're looking at local news, that's what I would encourage.
And I guess my takeaway is, please remember that in order to preserve democracy, we need to preserve the kind of discourse we're having here tonight, and that has to be reflected, and it has to be a commodity that we value. When your news source doesn't value both sides, doesn't value getting to the bottom and asking hard questions, that is cheating you on something that we should all value. So I think the Washington Post's, their motto is democracy dies in darkness, and I think we all can accept that and believe it.
Well said. If I could leave you with one thing, it would be that getting the civility bell rung on me was one of the great travesties of our age. No. I would say, you thought I was going to say something poignant there, didn't you? Seek contrary information and common ground and find the goodness in people with whom you disagree with, even if you disagree with them strongly. I'm preaching to the choir here, but I think civility and viewing things not emotionally but factually and keeping an open mind and learning, not reinforcing what you already think,
is the most important thing our society can do, and a great way to do that is to support your local newspaper.
I'm just the moderator, so I will say be kind to each other and keep reading, please. Thank you.